the record show, Senator Josephson, Senator Fisher, myself present, and would you please add others they've called that will be coming in, as they come in without me having to mention them. Today, we're very happy to have with us our council on handicapped and gifted. And John, I think you're just going to take over and show us how you are. I think we'll leave it completely up to you to introduce people and take from council 2:30 in whatever manner you'd like to do so.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I appreciate the time that the Senate House has allowed us to begin today. Rather than me go over and take care of everything, Bob Franklin is our legislative chairperson this year and has kind of set up the program. I'd like to turn over to him and let him take care of it.
Very well, Bob, can you get closer to the mic and we'll try to make that as convenient for you as possible?
Okay. The first thing that I'd like to do is to hand you our new legislative priorities books. We try and do this every year. And some of you already might have them.
I have one of those already. In fact, everybody in the committee has one.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And
we got them out to the committee members.
Just briefly go over the things that we do support. Many of these you're familiar with from hearing us in years past. And we aren't going to try and bore you with the same presentation that you've heard every year over and over again.
Thank you.
We do support Senate Bill 319, Special Education Service Agency, and we'll be talking about that more in the presentation. We support Senate Bill 168, which its companion bill is, I think, a Senate committee substitute for committee substitute of House Bill 172 now. It's the same rights legislation for the handicapped. Senate Bill 61, compulsory education for handicapped children, we support. House Bill 146, which is a housing loan program for severely disabled, we support and hope that it'll be reworked this year into potentially another bill. Senate Bill 377, handicapped access to public buildings, is obviously passed the House and is on its way to the Senate to be heard here, and we support that. Personal aid to tenant care legislation, we hear rumor that this committee is going to pass out a Senate committee substitute for HB 98. Plays us a great deal. Foundation formula funding as it relates to special education programs and the categorical funding that presents, we'll be talking about later in this program, and we support that. Again, we're asking for increments in infant learning, schools for the handicapped, community developmental disability grants, attendant care, adult services, and we would also especially like to remind you that last year when you passed the excise tax for cigarettes, that the intent of that legislation was that it be used for health promotional services, and in our examination of the governor's budget, we don't really see any new well programs being added to the budget, and that presents us a little concern. Programs such as low birth weight incident, children and neonatal. So without saying much more, I'd like to let John Nuttall address Senate Bill 319.
The council, last year I worked with Senator Jaroff's office, and with his cooperation and Senator Lodi put in SB 319, and I guess it's presently with your committee. I've also worked with Senator Jaroff's office since that time on cleaning up the bill, and they have tentatively written a committee substitute bill on 319. I believe you must have a copy of that.
I'm sure we do. That's it.
Basically, what 319 does is it takes the low incident outreach program that is presently with as a grant out to ETCA and gives that program a permanent home. It sets up a cooperative service agency that is a separate entity from the state. It's not a state employee, as underneath the new piece of legislation, the substitute. It would put that, give them a permanent home. It would also give them a form of funding rather than at the whim of the department. How much money do you want to put in there? And how much money can we take from them to pay this program? And the third major thing that it probably does is I think it will give the program some consistency. It's going to allow the people that are running the program, whoever that may be, to hire some teachers and to give those teachers the same benefits that the school districts can offer to them in the way of the CRA, teacher practices. presently, there has been some trouble with, there's problems with turnover, because quite frankly, you get these people that are experts in the field, and there's not a great deal of them out there in the United States. Definitely not enough for every school district to hire that type of person. So the services need to be there for the schools to keep those kids in their school districts, their home, and to teach them there in town, rather than to transfer them to Harborview or out of state. And right now we're seeing an increase in that. We'd like to stop that as much as possible by continuing those services. So basically that's what 319 will do. It'll give us a permanent home, give us a funding mechanism, and give us some solid base for those people to know that they're going to have a job and that they have the benefits that everybody else in the district and the state has, and not leave the program 6 months through and go to the anchor school system because there's an increase in benefits and salaries, as a matter of fact. And that's what we'd like to do, is to stabilize that program as much as possible.
Pardon me for whispering while you're doing that. When you bring up these things, you remind me of things I gotta make sure I take care of. No. Are there questions from any members of the committee or comments? Senator Fisher.
Is the new draft or the new idea you have, does that still leave the employees of this group in the teacher's retirement system or the public employee retirement?
Yes, it does.
Okay, now this supposes the fiscal note was such that would be the thing to either make or break it.
You're saying it'd be $60,000.
$60,000 mm-hmm. per year. Okay, then the other question I have, do you perceive this group as being set up with an executive director and the administrative type thing, or are going to all be out in the field, other than the commission itself?
Well, I think with any type of this type of program, you've got to have somebody that's coordinating the effort. There's going to have to be some sort of a program coordinator that is going to make sure that we don't send three people to the school system when we could do it with one person. So yes, there's got to be an administrator of some sort that's going to take care of that. I think anytime we're talking about $1.3 million, you've got to have at least somebody that knows who's doing that, that person's going, that we've got people covering what we're supposed to be covering, that we're meeting our agreements, and to just guarantee that we aren't doing duplicate nor omitting.
Okay, and then I guess the other, apparently it doesn't seem to be working because the term women in the department. Okay, now we're talking $100 per special ed person, right?
Yeah.
Which means it's now at the whim of each legislature each year. So where do you get the feeling, maybe you have a better feeling than I do, that this thing will be ongoing just because this statute says $100 per, when next year it could be changed to 50 or 25 or 100.
Yeah, I think we realize, of course, that the legislature has the ability to change the funding, even if there's the foundation formula is there, mm-hmm. you still are an appropriating body, and you're going to appropriate the amount of money that needs to be there. Right now, the problem we're seeing, for instance, this year, the department feels that there's a short funding in this particular area, in the grants line that they have, and they're looking for where to get that money. Back in December, they talked about, let's cut this particular program $300,000. Well, halfway through the year, if you take a 1.3 grant that's already spent $700,000 of money and cut $300,000 the remainder of the year, you might have to shut it down. I mean, that's essentially what they were doing. There had been no more travel. You had 15 teachers sitting in a building doing paperwork because there wasn't any travel money available. That's the type of thing that we were scared, that is happening. They did cut them $60,000 this year already. And there have been proposals by the department to start charging school districts for those services, which we were told in the development of the foundation formula, for instance, that those services would be there. So we feel that if it was in a separate BRU where if they were going to take money out of that program, they'd have to go through legislative budget and not sit down in a room and say, you know, we could cut that program by $200,000 and put it over here because we like this program better, or we need some money here, so let's just cut it out of that program. I guess that's part of the feeling. I think we realize that no matter what type of a funding formula is put into law, it's still the prerogative of the legislature to put in the amount of money that they feel is necessary there. And I think that every year, no matter what the form that calls for, that program is going to have to stand on its merits. We as a council, and I think the education community and the district, so we feel that it can probably do that without a great deal of effort.
Thank you.
Hunter, just one. When you define special ed, are you including the gifted as part of that or not?
Now, this project deals with low incidence students, the deaf, the blind, multiple handicapped, or physically handicapped, those really, really rare incidents. Those kids break the bank, and they move into your school district, and it costs you $75,000, $80,000 to bring in specialists to teach those kids. Districts can't afford that type of money, and what's happened in the past is the district says we can't do it. We don't have people, we can't find anybody to meet the IEP, so what the first thing they do is they transfer them out of state. You transfer a kid to California, it costs you $90,000 a year. If we can do that for $5,000 by sending educationally trained specialists out to train teachers to teach that kid, we're $85,000 ahead on that one student. And that's basically what that program is trying to do.
So, I'm sure, so then this program is more geared to teach the teacher, not to directly render services to the...
That's basically correct. It is not, they're not, they don't go out and spend a week teaching the kid. They come out in the system, they take a look at the kid, look at the IEP, how can we implement that? What do you need to know to implement that IEP? And perhaps, maybe Terry, who deals with the program directly, might be able to carry that.
Terry, if you'd like to join him.
Well, sure. Basically, for instance, in the Sitka School District, just to bring it home and give a real life flavor to this, we use the services of this outreach project, and we use it for children, for very few children in the district that are severely, profoundly retarded and multiply handicapped. We have a real good teacher hired. She was trained to do that, but she still needs some assistance every now and then. So about four times a year, we are visited by the outreach person for multiply handicapped children. And that individual comes down and assesses the children and their current level of functioning, takes a look at the driving force behind the child's program, the IEP, the individualized education program.
Thank you for speaking English.
And then sits down with the classroom teacher that's hired by the Sitka School District that already has a great deal of expertise but needed some extra assistance, and they work out what further details need to be done in order to meet that child's needs appropriately. Another example, we have just recently certified about 7 students in our high school that are emotionally disturbed. Well, after we did that, then there we sat with the psychologist report and these kids that need some real extra special help. The choice is not to help them, to ignore them, not to break the law and not give the services, and they end up as dropouts, and then later on you pass other laws to take care of their needs, you know, later on in society. And
we don't know what it means either. Let's stop that.
So, long as the roof doesn't quite give you,
maybe it's
we'll
just
okay.
Emphasizing your point.
That means everything you're saying is right.
So, there we sit with 5 to 7 new identified emotionally disturbed high school students, and we're all going, now what? We absolutely had no expertise on the staff. Nobody had had any training. We'd all been trained to work with retarded and or learning disabled kids. And so down comes to Sitka this expert, if you will, from the outreach project, and has made all the difference in the world. She studied the cases of the children. She met with the teachers and staff involved. Laid out a program plan for us for the remainder of this school year and a plan that would require us then to hire a teacher during the next school year to address the needs of the students. I would say that without that person coming from ARMSE, we would have had to find money somewhere in the budget and bring in an expert from down south somewhere at a very high cost. And those funds are just not there to bring those kinds of experts into the district. I can give one last example. Last week, I was invited to participate with the Cake School District in trying to determine some services for some children over there. So myself and another staff person, an occupational therapist, and the infant learning teacher, not connected with the school, but we work very closely with her, and she serves these children in Cake. And they all will turn 3 years of age and become legally school-aged children in the next 3 months. And the Cake School District has, I need to be tactful how to say this, they have never experienced multiply handicapped, severely profoundly handicapped children before in their district. They do not have programs, they do not have expertise. We were invited over to give them some assistance. We also asked that the outreach program in Anchorage send an expert down with us. So we all converged on Cape. We assessed the children, we looked at the facilities, we checked with the Head Start program, we interviewed a number of people in the community that had input into what could happen for these children, and we left with a plan of attack. One of the most, one of the top priorities in our plan of attack, if you will, for the principal of what he needed to do from now until June to get these programs in shape, was to contact RMZ or the Outreach Project and ask for their services for the remainder of the school year and next year. And he was told that they doubted that he was going to be able to get the services of the Outreach Project due to the department's cut of $60,000 last Monday. So it hits home real heavy right there in the little school district of Cake. And my question is, what's Cake going to do to get services into those kids in that district? I mean, there's nobody there that can handle the situation.
Thank you. That starts with this. RMZ at the present time the only agency that can assist in cases like this, and I assume they are funded through a grant process?
Yes. RMZ is the outreach component that I've made reference to during this, this discussion, and they are the only agency within the state of Alaska, and they are funded through the Department of Education through the grants program. And the department has the ability then to go into those grants and alter them and adjust and reduce funds.
So the department itself is not, of education, is not staffed to provide any of these special services? Is that a correct statement?
That's correct.
And the legislation, which is not before us but is in our packet, would establish an agency connected to the Department of Education but a part of the state government to take over and provide these services, but on a broader level. Is that correct?
What do you mean by part of the state government?
Well, it has to be. I mean, it's attached to the Department of Education.
It's an outreach project that, yeah, but they aren't employees in the state. I guess they are not state employees. Okay, it's much like the Regional Resource Center situation where you have people that they get grants and assist in that, but they are not employees in the state of Alaska. And this is the same situation. This is a similar situation.
That's contract. The grants come through bids or through contracts? Or
through RFPs, yes.
I hate to say this, but I'm going to have to caution you that we have five or six more items.
Yeah. We have three items that we're going to deal with. Two more items that we're going to deal with.
I'm not trying to rush you. We will be, of course, hearing this bill and appreciate input at that time as well. We would like to have as much of a feeling as we have time to give on this. As you notice, there's interest and lots of questions. Are there further questions or comments? Thank you very, very much.
Terry Kuhn is going to deal with the foundation formula as it deals with special education.
Yes, you get to listen to me for a few more minutes. I apologize. I just think it's real important, though, to give some real concrete examples of what we're talking about when we're talking about services, human services to people in our state. And I think those were maybe three examples that you can relate to, at least I hope so.
Have you given, as a group, any close attention to the new budget on the federal level and what happens to people services?
We're just beginning to get some implications of what's happening there, and it's
pretty. We're
real concerned with what's going on, but nobody can give us real firm numbers yet.
We've got somebody that could help you, I'm sure, and that's Rick Halperts, AA, who's very familiar with the legislation and has some facts and figures concerning Alaska. It might be good for you to try to meet with him as a group to see where we're going and how we pick up the shortfall, because believe me, there is. You know, it's nothing like being a bearer of good news, but don't shoot the messenger. Rick Halperts.
Joe,
am I misrepresenting you? I know that I'm not supposed to put you on the spot, but have fun.
Okay. Well, first of all, I think on behalf of the council, we'd like to publicly compliment and thank the Department of Education and Larry Huxtell specifically for the manner in which they went about the entire last year of putting together the foundation proposal. It was one of the most open and insightful processes that the Governor's Council has participated in a long while. We were almost overwhelmed. We formed a committee the governor's council did. We wanted to take a look at special education funding, and we were very unsure of who would be making the decisions about the special education funding in the proposed plan. We had our first meeting with Dr. Huxell, and lo and behold, he chose to use our committee, Lock, Stock, and Barrel, as the broad-based representative group that would help develop special education. And after a few minutes of formalities, maybe an hour's worth, we rolled our sleeves up, we dug in, and at the end of the first day, we had devised what basically is in the proposal at this point in time. We then went home feeling pretty proud of ourselves, started to apply some figures, went back and looked at the document that had been written in the past 3 years, was revised 3 years ago, and we again took a look at it, and the department had a small task force take another look at it, and that document is called the program standards. That is not yet regulatory, but we felt that whatever funding mechanism we created needed to take a look at program standards. So we went back and looked at the special education program standards, and much to our chagrin, we found one, much of it matched very well, the ratios for resource services and self-contained and that sort of thing, but the problem arose when we looked at the gifted and talented, and we found that on one hand, we had a 30-to-1 ratio in our standards, meaning for every 30 students, you should have a teacher. And then we looked at the way that we had written the foundation proposal, and basically there we were talking a program. For every 40 students, you get a program, and a program basically generating enough money, a program is basically a teacher. So we had a discrepancy between the 30-to-1 and the 40-to-1, and the next time that the special education group got together with Dr. Huxell, he had already been back to the main body and had already passed and had everybody approve of what we had done the previous meeting. And we brought it to his attention, and you know, there were gee whiz and golly, and we just decided we couldn't go back and change it at that point. So the council is supporting the proposal that the state school board passed last 2 weeks ago at their last meeting, and if we are supporting the entire foundation package proposal, specifically the special education part, with one minor change, and we recommend strongly that the gifted weighted ratio be changed from 1 to 40 to 1 to 30. And we have to be upfront and honest with you. In your packet, you'll see that the new foundation proposal would generate for special education about $61.5 million. The old proposal generated $67.5 million. The request that we're asking of you to change the ratio from 1 to 40 to 1 to 30 would probably mean an additional $5 million. But it's needed. It's needed to provide services to the gifted students within the state of Alaska. The unfortunate thing we're not able to tell you at this time is that of the old money, the $67.5 million, we're not sure at all how much of that was spent in special ed. We think a massive amount of it was, but there are no statistics, as you know, to back up where that money went. So the council at this time supports the foundation proposal, and we encourage the department and the new legislation to support an accounting mechanism that will track this new money so that we can find out where indeed it has gone in the next few years. Maybe if I could answer some questions.
Senator Josephson.
Thank you, Senator. Under the proposal, you would have to, a district would have to account for the principal redistricting. You'd have to verify that the money was spent for special education. Is that right?
That's right. Well, not verify that it was spent in special education, but you'd have to verify where the money was spent. Currently, there are a number of options allowed school districts, and not all districts are using the accounting codes the way that they were intended. They're because of the options that were built in. And I think the department is looking at possibly narrowing those options down and requiring a more finite accounting procedure. That's my understanding.
One of the issues that we hear about is that the concept of say, a gifted person is somewhat nebulous and may be informed by the availability of money for the purpose. I think the department tells me that at various times, both with disadvantaged or handicapped people and gifted people, when there was no particular funding increment available, there were X numbers of people in those categories reportedly, when the funding increment became available, it became X plus Y. You know what I'm driving at here?
Yes.
Does the adoption of the formula with the increment tend to place more people in the gifted category, for example, than would otherwise be there?
I don't believe it would, because at the same time that that we're looking at the foundation proposal at the department is also looking at this thing that I referred to earlier, the program standards. And the program standards, if those are tight enough, districts aren't going to have the option of playing with numbers of kids and placing them incorrectly into inappropriate categories of special education for funding. It would make it more difficult.
And they couldn't just place them count-wise into a program. They physically have to place them into a program in order for that to count.
They'd have to offer the service.
Yes.
Right.
I mean, there's a theory, you know, that every child is gifted. And that's only half the seizures. I mean, every child.
There's also a theory, sir, that every child is handicapped.
I think that that both propositions have a certain.
Mm-hmm.
But in summary, you think that from a regulatory or administrative point of view, that problem can be handled.
Well, my personal opinion would be yes. As somebody on the firing line on a day-to-day basis, as an administrator of one such program, I think that that can be regulated, and I think that that regulation can be done through the program standards and through department audits on the districts that take place anyway. So I think that that's something that we can live with. But maybe another person in the group has another attitude.
Senator Sturgeon,
I think the only thing is that there needs to be a mechanism to do just that, because we're playing games if we put it out just to enrich and do the program. I mean, it's for a purpose, and I think those standards have to be set. It's not easy to quantify, but that doesn't mean it's impossible.
No, and that's, you know, that's kind of a problem with education in the whole
state
of Alaska.
That's true. It's not just there.
We've talked for years about a basic education, and your definition, Senator, and yours, and they may all be a little bit different, and they are different. You talk to 55 different school superintendents, and they'll each one tell you a different definition of a basic education. Likewise, in the special ed realm, you get 55 special ed people together, and they'll have, you know, a program is this, a program is that, and you'll have a widespread difference of opinion about what the program should be. And therefore, that causes some concern, too, when on one hand we say you're going to generate X number of dollars, is that enough to run your special ed program? I might have X number of standards, and I'd say, sure, that money will do the job, where Bob, on the other hand, has higher expectations or higher standards, and he says, are you kidding? I couldn't possibly run my program on X number of dollars. So the program standards is really a very important piece of regulation that needs to be there, and it isn't at the moment. And we did take a look at that, and it's ready to go for regulation, but I don't know where it is or what's happened at this point.
Well, I think I can speak pretty much for the feeling that we've had expressed on this committee, and that is, you know, we used to have a form of funding by units. And then some districts just found out, you know, that you could count them a little different way at a certain range in there. And it was beneficial, let's say, a little creative, sure, bookkeeping. And the problems arose to such an extent, threw the thing out. And ever since then, we've lived with what we have now, which is nothing. And our chances at the present of finding agreement when both organized districts and unorganized districts, if they lose money, they're for it, and if they don't, they're not. And that's human nature. Now, I'd like to probe a little further into this 5 or 6 million more that the 40-1 and 30-1 ratio would affect. What we've been looking at now, as we look at the foundation formula for education, is that even to keep the status quo and no foundation formula, we need another $13 million from what's in there. And in order to put in a foundation formula that has any chance of flying, we're going to need at least $20 million extra bucks, and maybe 30. So as you're talking to people, and as you advocate a foundation formula, for goodness sakes, have that in mind and and bring it up, because we need all the help we can get.
I think one thing that may be a misunderstanding is I think the $5 to $6 million Terry's talking about is not a $5 to $6 million increase in the foundation. What it is, it's a reallocation process.
Yeah, but every time you allocate, honey, you take it from someplace.
Yeah, that's right.
Don't play that game with me.
No, what it is is that taking the $494 bucket of money out there and calculating the number of units out there, they divide it to get, each unit gets $2,000 or whatever. The process of by increasing the students from 40 to 30 would increase enough units that what it would do is it would take the $494, it would take $6 million out of what would go to the school districts as general, the regular ed, and put it into special ed as an identification for programs. Probably, looking at it, would probably not shift money from district to district.
But within
the program itself, it would just be what we're interested in some categorical funding so that we can look at that and say, here's the money you're getting for special ed. Is it being spent? Isn't it? If it isn't, why is it? Is it not needed? Are we funding too much? Are we not enough? Or whatever the case may be. And I think that's what we're looking at. It's not an actual.
I'm well aware of that, but you also know that those schools who have smaller numbers involved in the programs, in their what is called the basic ed section, which is the K-12, would then be lessened. And I'm just telling you facts of life. Somebody's going to gripe about it, and maybe a lot of somebody. You know, and I'm not saying I don't support what you're saying, and understand the rationale. I'm just saying, as you are discussing with your legislators your package, please be aware that you must impress the fact that it's going to take some more money and it needs to be done anyway.
And we appreciate that advice. We're going to work hard at foundation forming and funding. It's one that's real important to us. You expressed to us last year real concern about categorical funding for special education. We took that hard work hard on this year.
Good. And I appreciate
back your support.
And Jerry, I'm not trying to chew you out, man. I'm trying to get you on my team.
I appreciate it.
You know, you're trying to sell me. I got a right to sell you back, right?
Well, okay.
We need to move on. Ryan Burns, who's not a member of the council, has agreed to represent the council's position on personal care attendance. And that test is a major piece of legislation that you're going to deal with this year. He and I drive the same model of car.
I got my first. I want to thank you for letting me be here, Senator Josephson, on your comment about the differentiation between gifted and disadvantaged. In our office, our staff feel that I'm disadvantaged and gifted. Because I'm gifted as a bureaucrat, they feel that's a real disadvantage. Anyway, I just am here, and I've talked to all of you about this a number of times before, but personal care attendance services is a vitally important issue to persons who experience a disability. And there is legislation now that Governor did attach the Medicaid statute change to HB 98, and we're here to ask you to support that legislation. And the legislation will make personal care attendance services available to individuals who receive Medicaid benefits and would make it available on a match by the federal government and the state, and would make those services available statewide. And that's real encouraging. And once the legislation goes through, then we can work out some of the details that I have some concerns about. But
are you going to be here Tuesday?
I wasn't planning that, but if you want me to be,
well, just in case any of you are interested, that bill will be heard in this committee Tuesday.
Somebody will be here. Okay. But basically, I think I've told most of you what personal care attendance services are, and you know that, so I won't go into that any further.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I think it would be important. I wonder if there's any the thing of a teleconference or something so people don't have to come down. But you did make a very effective presentation before, but I'm a little bit dim in my memory as to how, by passing that and opening up for Medicare, I don't think it's a competitive situation. It just means that service helps a certain number out there. It doesn't handle the whole problem, but it does open some opportunity. Is that not correct?
It's a start. But this year, because the governor didn't put the funding in for the general relief medical.
Mm-hmm.
That really makes it a grave situation.
So that, well, at least we bring a few people on. Yeah.
Right, and it's a start, and it's really better than we've had before. And I know the Department of Health being and Social Services being the wise group that they are going to let us work with them to work out some of the concerns I have and about the maximum hours that they put in their increment. But still, it's a start, and it doesn't deal with disincentives for persons who want to be employed and all of that. But right now, I just want to see the people that are in the community not have to go into an institutional setting because the attendant care is not available. And so we're taking it a bit at a time.
The cost factor alone is a great argument in your favor. And there's another place where I think we're going to have to watch very carefully and make sure that we do cover some of these areas. And then we're still going to be hurting more. Any questions or comments from members of the committee?
Good answer.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah. The comment was there are lots of holes out there to be filled. And our feeling is there certainly are.
Yeah, with the GRMed budget being cut as bad as it is this year, though, we've lost everything, the little we did have in person with IndiCare. Mm-hmm. If nothing happens, we can start putting people back in nursing homes that are 20 to 30 years old, and that'll cost you a few more bucks.
I think that's something that's important in your discussions. I know that both sides of this body will be, as I understand it, having a caucus very shortly to set lids. And I certainly expect and hope to have the help of this committee as we're examining lids as they're set before the Finance Committee, because mm-hmm. the governor's document is not ironclad. You know, it's a start.
Senator, when the governor's budget message came down, and he gave his budget message to the public, my recollection is that he said that there were cuts in most areas, and there were and there were increases in some areas. He mentioned tests, and he mentioned corrections. And I hope maybe as a committee we can sit down and really tear that apart and see if those are increases that help folks or not. Because I think we really, as a committee, can make a contribution in that discussion.
Senator, it's my understanding that many of the increases that Department of Health and Social Services took were increases in base funding support. Food stamp programs going up in cost. Other age-dependent children mm-hmm. going up in cost.
Yeah, and
so a lot of that, most of the increase was base budget support increase, stuff that we had to increase.
Just because of the number of clients and people.
Yes.
Well, I think we need to be able to show where the factors of harm are and whether or not there is indeed true increases.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that's I agree with Senator Josephson, that not only factors of harm, but you throw it on another load of the thing. I mean, if you want to be cost effective, it sure isn't to take somebody out of a situation at one cost and double it somewhere else if that care is going to have to be there. So I wonder if that's something we could ask the department to supply us.
Joe, don't you have some figures on that?
Connie has some.
Connie.
Senator, also, at this point, we are hoping that the governor allows the general medical bill to grandfather those people who are already receiving what we call general medical waivers, which would be like the access lost clients, but the amount in that budget is not going to allow any new clients in that category. It's only going to be able to support major in-hospital medical and pregnancy-related services. It's definitely one of the reasons that we urge the governor to pick up and come forward and support something like personal care attendants, because that's where we get 50% funding match from the federal government. It's not like the community-based waiver program. If you pass the bill and you give us the money, the feds will plug in there. It's not like community-based waiver. You don't have to jump through hoops and wait 2 years for them to say maybe yes. One of the reasons is to try and find more federal money where we can before the federal spending caps. And there are some trade-offs. We need $4 million growing and covered to a more, you know, emergency life-threatening, disability-threatening major medical service. Not necessarily we necessarily want to do, but it's around.
I would just like to point out, though, that even the eight that are served through GR Med at this time, they are in Anchorage, and there's a need statewide, and we don't feel, and those eight are targeted, and I still get gray hairs when I hear the word hoping that they'll be grandfathered, because that one word concerns me, because we hear hoping so much, and then, you know, we've heard that the $500,000 was going to be in the governor's budget. They were hoping it was, and it wasn't, and so that's still a concern.
At my age, I hear grandfather involved now.
Why did you start the grand, baby?
We are complete. We're done. We're done 9 minutes early. Unless anyone has any questions on anything that's on or in the packets, we have other council members here who would be more than happy to answer questions on any subject we feel confident on.
Are there questions or items of discussion?
I was wondering on the House bill that came over, was there any amendments to that? So are you still supporting with that House bill?
House Bill 377?
Yes, uh-huh.
Yes, we have been real supportive of House Bill 377. There was a lot of arguments in the House apparently about things like why make the governor make state ferries accessible, because they never see any handicapped people using them. Well, being in this thing and having ridden about the sewer to Valdez Ferry once, I can explain to you why handicapped people don't use them very often. You people have been real nice in giving me this pass to ride any ferry I want, anytime for free, on a standby basis, but I can't do that very easily. They're very difficult to get around it. You passed a law in 1976 that says every state building needs to be accessible. And it is the responsibility of the Commissioner of Department of Transportation and Public Facilities to ensure that that law is being carried forward. It is the responsibility of the Department of Administration to make sure new buildings are not being leased that are not accessible. Both of those laws are regularly being ignored. The council is real concerned about that. This bill puts the final responsibility on the governor of Alaska to continue the improvement process for all public buildings. I still cannot get into the new state office building. And it has been, as far as I know, .puff had money. I was told last year when I was down that .puff had money to modify that building and make it accessible. I go in through the garage of the new state office building on the lower side. On the upper side, the only way I get into that building is through the garage of the old state office building, and hope that garage door is open, hope the mailroom door is open, then go to the elevators and ride those up to the walkway across, and then I can go in and see someone in that building.
I'd like to add to that, too, that with the state ferry issue, it's kind of an amusing story. When I first came to Alaska a year and a half ago, I had called ahead and asked about the Columbia to be sure, and they said, oh, yeah, it's accessible. We just made all these modifications to the bathroom, and you'll really like it. And so I thought, well, I can deal with that then. And I got on the Columbia and started looking around, and I went to the woman at the desk, and she said, oh, yes, we have this, you're the first person who's ever been on the ferry to ask about this. But we've got this beautiful, accessible bathroom. And she started taking me back, and we were going down the hall, and as we got right towards this opening, she slowed down and she said, huh. And I said, what's wrong? And she was standing in front of four steps, and she said, well, the bathroom right up there. Well, where's the elevator? I'm sure that gets down to it. She said, no, it doesn't. And I said, well,
they are spending on capital budgets nowadays, are going to, at least a portion of those will be directed to retrofitting buildings that are already in existence. When I testified before the Senate, I can't remember what committee it was, on Senate Bill 168, which is the same thing as Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute on House Bill 172, and the rights of disabled people are critically impaired people to serve on jury duty. The court system asked for an exemption from having to modify their buildings in Nome and some of the other courts that they have that are on the second floor of rented because in 1976, nobody's have been leasing space that is not accessible. In fact, the state law does say that. And if I had been the one who committed the murder, or committed murders in Nome, I think they'd found a way to get me to the trial. So, you know, I think that this, that 377 only begins the process of bringing buildings into place. And for us, it's a real appropriate year to do that. This is the International Decade on Disability, Year of Accessibility. And it's real important to make people aware of the wonderful curbs out here, some of which have curb cuts now, but down on the other side, where the Capitol building, where about 80% of your offices are not accessible. Some of that needs to change.
Has there ever been any study about how expensive it would be to make this Capitol building accessible? What do you have to do? You have to come in through the Senate or the House chambers? Is that the way we've been in here?
We come in, Dwayne and I sort of struggle up this hill on the, sort of side, the south side of the hill, and come up to the to a ramp that's sort of been put in there, but we can't use the sidewalk to get up because there's three steps right before we get to the ramp they put in. So we got to come up the street, the middle of the street, and come into the, to sort of a cutaway in the street there, go off the ramp, and then they've got this, you know, being a smoker, I have nothing against designated smoking areas, but they have this designated smoking area with nice chairs and lounges and coffee table sitting right in the middle of this entrance that I'm supposed to use for my wheelchair, with file cabinets stuck right in there. And then when we get into here, most of the hallways are, well, they're at least reasonable, but then most of the offices are so small and over and so much staff sitting in them that we can't...
Didn't say overstaffed because I need some more.
I did not say overstaffed. I wouldn't be kidding that, Senator. You know, the utilization is very high in these offices. Most of them are
well said. Well.
Has there ever been an estimate of what it would cost to make this building?
There was a physical of the company. We used to have a... I used to park up on top on the parking level, and there was access through the Senate chamber. That is, if you happen to, you know, come at the right time in that piece of grating that they put down so that you wouldn't have to go up the steps to get on the grating, it wasn't too slick. But, you know, I've fallen on my fanny on that thing a lot of times, and I can imagine it would be awful nice. And trying to get there and then stand banging on the door while we're in session.
Yeah, not good way. Senator DeVries, so I think that one thing is the education is real important because I have found two different approaches in getting in the same door. One is a straight, you go up a curb cut and it's straight. You don't have to use the ramp. And sometimes you need to use that one if someone's parked in front of the one that goes to the ramp. And then if you get on that one, sometimes if the trash cans are right in front of it, you can't get through. So you have to take the other one. So if you get a good day and someone's parked in front of one and the trash cans are in front of both, then it's inaccessible. And so there's some of the little things that don't have to cost a lot of money. It just takes a little bit of thought and awareness. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. At least. I think we'll take 1 minute. Thank all of you very, very much for spoiling our day. And I think you know how I mean that. We as a committee look daily at almost at problems that just seem
monumental.
Yeah, and you've given us a few more little nice things to think about. But as usual, we enjoy very, very much your being here and the work that you're doing to try to help us.
But isn't it great
to solve these problems?
Isn't it great that they gave input on the foundation formula and there's a support group? Because frankly, there's some problems. It's taken 5 years, really, of discussion on that. There's some really strong political problems because of this win-lose thing, and it's going to take all the help it can. We need a new foundation formula that's tied to some kind of measurable standard. So I think it's great you had input there, but help us get
that
through. Don't stop now. I mean, it really is important. If you get your 30 or 40, I mean, that's debatable and has to be in on it. But I think it's critical we get a formula that ties to something. So, you know, use your juice to help us.
I'd rather have a foot in the door than have a trash can set in the front of it. You know, not get started.
Madam Chair, we, and Senators, we appreciate the time that you've given us, not only today, but every year that we come down here, and we appreciate your support on the issues that are really critical for the handicapped community. And we thank you.
I'm going to put in now a 1 minute break for those of you who may not feel that you can stay to hear the presentation of another slight little problem. So if you're most welcome to stay if you like, but for those of you, so you won't have embarrassment of walking out in the middle of the committee and think maybe we'll get angry with you, we'll take, please, 1 minute committee. We have with us Commissioner Pugh, and Commissioner, would you please just introduce and carry on from there?
Madam Chair and committee members, this afternoon, Elizabeth Ward is Director of Public Health, and Dr. John Middow, who is the head of our epidemiology section for the state, and will be presenting on AIDS, both some historical kind of data about our program in the state, and giving some idea of our future direction for how we're doing.
Please proceed.
Thank you. I know you were headed some information that we hope would be useful and you can use as reference. I'm going to ask Dr. Middow to do a quick summary of that information, highlight particular issues that we think are important, and then we'll be available for questions.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to come and try to present some information. I know that you probably all actually know quite a bit about AIDS, but I thought just to start with, I might go and just sort of introduce AIDS a little bit about what it is, and then talk about the cases and what we know about AIDS and its occurrence in Alaska, and then describe briefly the state's program as it exists today. As I'm sure you know by now, AIDS is a new infection in the United States. It was first described and reported in 1981, and it was based on the recognition of unusual disease infections occurring in populations of individuals where they had not previously been recognized. Studies done nationally were able to determine that the disease was very likely caused by an infectious agent, but initially it was not known what the agent was. Continued research then elaborated and discovered that the infection is an infection and it's caused by a virus. And the virus had previously not been identified, nor had it previously been identified as causing the types of illnesses that were being seen in the United States. And so the virus had went through an evolution of understanding, being characterized by the researchers in France and in America, and is now known as the human T-cell lymphotropic virus, or HTLV-3, is the initials for it's commonly referred to. And as additional research took place and the tests were developed to be able to measure in the blood antibodies, then it became much more easy to learn about the epidemiology of the infection. Who gets it? How is the infection transmitted? The virus itself is one that, like any other agent, when it infects the body, it's recognized by the body's immune system as a foreign material, and antibodies are then formed, and the antibodies are very specific against that virus. And so the tests that have been developed, the blood tests for screening, actually measure the antibodies and do not presently, there are no tests generally available to detect the virus, although it can be detected in research laboratories. The virus itself causes the abnormalities which result in disease by impairing the body's natural immune system so that opportunistic infections, in other words, very rare infections previously caused by viruses or bacteria that in a normal person with a normal immune system would not cause illness, cause devastating illness in people because of the impairment of the immune system. The virus has been extensively studied. There are now over 16,000 individuals who have been diagnosed with AIDS. I need to say just a little bit about that because the infection with the virus may or may not lead to clinical illness or disease. The infection.
16,000 where?
In the United States. Since the disease was recognized in 1981. The virus itself, when it enters the body, can remain latent with no symptoms. So there's a spectrum of infection with the virus with no symptoms at all through the impairment of the immune system with the manifestation of that impairment through disease with a very high mortality. And AIDS itself, the acquired immune deficiency, syndrome is a constellation of diseases and abnormalities in the body that together allows someone to say a person has AIDS. So when people talk about cases of AIDS, they're individuals with a constellation of symptoms and impairments that result in meeting a case definition of illness, and it's in those individuals that the tremendous mortality has occurred. Now, in Alaska, since 1981 through the present time, we've had 14 cases of AIDS that meet these case definitions. And out of those 14, that's through January 1st of this year. Of the 14 Alaskans, 13 have been male and one female. All have been adults and members of known high-risk groups. And the virus clearly has been generally confined to certain high-risk groups. The cases have occurred in various parts of the state. There's a little map on the, or a little diagram that we've handed out to you that lists the communities. And out of the 14 individuals, 9 are known to have died. It's possible that some of the others have died, but we don't have an ability to follow all of them. Some leave the state for to seek therapy, and we don't have a mechanism to track the individual cases. Let me just summarize now briefly the components of our state program. Actually, beginning in 1981, when the cases were first recognized and reported in the literature, our office, in conjunction with the Centers for Disease Control Arctic Investigations Laboratory at Anchorage, established a voluntary reporting and surveillance system throughout the state with the medical community so that cases were reported to us and investigated on a voluntary basis. In January of 1985, through regulation, we made AIDS a reportable disease, and it has then continued to be reported to our office. When cases are reported, we complete formal investigation of those individuals and complete a standard case form, which we then submit to the National Centers for Disease Control in order that we participate in the nationwide surveillance for this disease. And we do that for many other infections as well. In addition to that ongoing reporting and surveillance component of the program, then in May of 85 was when the first blood test became available, was licensed in order to detect the antibodies to AIDS. And initially, when the test was developed, its purpose was quite limited. The purpose was to protect the nation's blood supply. And because the test only detects the antibodies, it is not a diagnostic test for AIDS itself or the cases. And so the thought behind the development of the test was that since it's known that the virus is transmitted by blood and blood products, that if individuals were infected with the virus and had a positive antibody test, even though they might not have the disease and they might not be infectious and they might not go on to get the disease, that it would be appropriate to exclude them from blood donation so that there would not be any potential contamination of the blood supply. And so at the time that the test was developed and announced nationally and then put into place, it was for the purpose of protecting blood donation and the blood supply and screening out any individual with a positive test so that that the virus would not potentially contaminate blood that would be given to another individual. Now, at that time, there was a great concern that individuals in the high-risk groups might wish to get the test, not to donate blood, but in order to find out the results of their test. And so in order to protect the blood supplies from a potential deluge of individuals coming to get the test, it was funded by the National Centers for Disease Control grant monies to all the states to develop the laboratory capacity to perform the test in alternate sites. So in May of 1985, the Division of Public Health through its section of laboratories developed 2 alternate test sites and then subsequently has added 3 others to provide that testing. The blood bank screening has up to this time screened approximately 6,000 donors. And so far, only one individual in the state has been found positive. That was an individual very early on who was a known member of a high-risk group who stated that the reason he went there was to get the blood test to see his result, not to donate blood. The Northern Regional Laboratory has screened blood in rural areas for the walking donor program in rural hospitals, and so far, 300 people screened have been positive, but since that's the only place in some of those communities where any individual could get the test, we believe that some of those individuals were in high-risk groups, were not intending to donate the blood.
Doctor, what was your figure again?
300 of 300.
300 of 300.
But we believe that there are high-risk groups who, just like in the Anchorage area, went to get the test to get the result, not to donate blood.
Excuse me. I'm confused. Did we not vote or put in appropriation for screening of high-risk groups in two areas?
Or was it hepatitis B?
Oh, that was hepatitis B. Pardon me.
Now,
I'm confused.
When the screening began in the alternate test sites, there was a very important component, and that had to do with the fact that there are great limitations in the test. There's a new test, and it wasn't clear, and still isn't completely clear, how sensitive and specific the test is. In other words, if you get a test result back and it says the test is positive, is it an accurate test? Does that mean that you, in fact, have been infected and that you can rely on a test result? And the same thing, if the test is negative, can we be sure that the test is really negative and the person isn't infected? Well, the answer is for any test in medicine, it's never 100% either way. And so consequently, as basically a condition to perform the test, pre-test and post-test counseling was implemented so that each individual could be informed about the test, about what the results meant, and if the test was positive, when they got the results, to counsel in risk reduction behaviors to reduce any transmission that potentially could occur. Now, all the information is held strictly confidential, and up through this time, Alaska has tested approximately 1,000 individuals of all types, of which about 92 have been positive in these alternate test sites, and these are the blood screens. Now, to give you a comparison, because we're pretty enthusiastic that our program has been pretty successful, in all of New York State, since these tests were available, they've only tested 4,500, and in all of Florida, 5,000. And so the rate at which we're testing high-risk group individuals is about 3 to 4 times higher than in those other places. Now, in October 1985, Commissioner Pugh appointed an AIDS task force. And the task force is comprised of individuals from the department, from the private medical community, from the Indian Health Service, and from the Centers for Disease Control. And we also call upon numerous other individuals to come and help. And the purpose of that task force was to address recommendations for policy issues, for instance, relative to schools, daycare, foster care, corrections, EMS, and universities. And those policies were developed according to national guidelines in conjunction with consultation to other state health departments, the school districts, the corrections officials, et cetera, and then were endorsed by numerous agencies in the state and have now officially been released. And those continue to be reviewed constantly, and new ones are underway to be developed relative to hospital care, nursing care, and universities. Then, in addition, the task force has been trying to identify areas where additional work or concerns need to be addressed, and they recommended that a new working group be constituted to address issues such as healthcare financing for affected individuals, because nationally, many individuals in high-risk groups who are developing AIDS do not have health insurance and may not have financial resources to cover their care. And so that working group has been established recently to get experts to help advise us as to what the potential implications may be in the future for provision of hospital care, some of which can be quite intensive and expensive. Then another area, of course, is education. And there are three major areas of education that we believe need to be addressed. One is the general public. The second are physicians and other healthcare professionals about the technical information of care and maintenance of patients who develop AIDS. And then the third is directed risk reduction educational material for the high-risk groups. In addition, we're trying to develop a network of AIDS knowledgeable physicians as resources to communities throughout the state. And the State Medical Association, working with our office, is in the process of finding folks in each community who, if there's a problem or a concern that arises, will be knowledgeable and will be resources to that community to try to answer questions about AIDS or concerns about AIDS locally, and of course, who that we can send material to, and they can call upon us if we can help them. And finally, we're quite concerned about the issues of confidentiality, as others are around the country, and that continues and will continue to be a major concern in the future. We think that up till now, looking at what other states are doing, looking at national guidelines, and looking at what the needs of our community have been and will continue to be, we think that this program has been very effective in, at least up to now, meeting many of the needs, and that we hope that in the future we'll be able to identify things like expansion of our alternate test sites, improving our ability to address education efforts, and to continue, of course, the program that we have now. Two areas of great concern are, one, we want to expand our efforts to identify and counsel and screen members of high-risk groups. This virus is very difficult to catch. It is not transmitted through the air, through water, through food, through casual contact in schools or family members. And what we want to do is use our knowledge of public health and epidemiology to focus in on the populations who are at the greatest risk of infection, to identify members who have been infected, who may then be able potentially to transmit the virus to other members, and to work with those infected individuals to behaviorally identify ways that they can reduce the risk of transmission. This is occurring nationally, it's starting to be effective, and the rate of increase of cases of AIDS in the country is slowing down. One thing that we all need to realize, and then I'll be quiet, is that this virus has a very long incubation period, anywhere from 2 to 7 years, and perhaps as long as 20 years. The importance of that is that efforts today that are effective in reducing transmission may not be noticeable, or we may not be able to have evidence for many years, because cases will continue to occur now that we will identify of individuals who might have been infected 2, 5, 7 years ago, before those public health or risk reduction efforts got into place. And so we can expect nationally and in Alaska to continue to see more cases occur, but based on other evidence, it looks very likely that the risk reduction efforts are changing behavior, are reducing the transmission of the virus, and of course our ultimate hope is that research will identify a vaccine or some medical therapy that will eradicate the virus or reduce its ability, or eradicate its ability to be transmitted.
Just want to say, we've had a lot of presentations. I think yours were just great. Very succinct. You hit the brilliant job. But I do want to compliment you for, you've included here your policies for correctional facilities, for schools, for daycare. You didn't wait for major problems, and I think it's been handled extremely well. And I really compliment you and the commissioner and so on for that. This one question, is there anything that we're doing as a state that assists? Obviously, we're not into research and finding solutions, but is there anything that the state does that assists in that bigger effort to try to find some answers to this, the problem of AIDS?
I really don't believe that we can be effective in basic research. We have a small population and very few number of cases compared to.
I just wondered, anything in the way we're taking information and so on, if that's a value in the work that's going on to try to find the answers.
Well, I think that the efforts right now that are very important in providing information to the Alaska community, and so far our experience has paralleled very much that of many other states in the country in terms of groups affected and the type of transmission that's occurred. When I prepared this material, I wasn't aware, but now am, that in fact we do have a funding problem. Our efforts up till this time have been supported entirely with a grant from the National Centers for Disease Control, which enabled us to buy the test kits, develop the lab testing, hire the counselors, and maintain that effort. And we had anticipated that there would be new federal grant money available. And in fact, it's been held up now in Washington, and our funds will expire completely on April 22nd. And so we know that unless somehow we can acquire funds to maintain the program, that we would not even be able to perform a serological test to screen someone for AIDS after that time. And so we have that immediate problem of how are we going to maintain our program from April 22nd to June 30th. And then the task force took upon itself to review the entire AIDS program and what's happening with AIDS nationally and what optimally could the state be doing in the future. And based on that, it prepared a proposed budget to send to the department for its consideration and review for the next year. And I think that, as I mentioned before, one of the major benefits of the AIDS program to Alaska would be to substantially expand our efforts to test and counsel high-risk groups. And up to now, both nationally and here in Alaska, that effort has been relatively low-key because of, I believe, the very high esteem and trust of the public health workers who have been involved in this effort. There has been a high rate of testing of individuals, much higher than in many other parts of the country. But our efforts can be very successful in reducing the transmission of the disease. A cholera epidemic was stopped in London in 1784 by an epidemiologist, and that was prior to the development of the germ theory of disease. And we don't need to wait for a vaccine or some national or international breakthrough of treatment to reduce the transmission of the virus. And nationally, and here in Alaska, it's very clear that our major effectiveness now could be if we could expand those efforts. And I think the other thing that would need to continue is our ability to provide good educational material to the public. There is a tremendous amount of information scientifically known about the virus, almost all of which is very reassuring to the general public about the transmissibility of the virus. But there's a great gap between that scientific knowledge and its reassurance and public perception of individual risk. And I think that that's an area where we need to do much more so that we can translate those scientific papers and research findings into real information that can be beneficial to all of our communities. And those are two areas that I think need expansion in the next year.
When we speak of expansion, and I couldn't agree with you more, that education, I think, is essential. I'm sure all of us here have run into individuals who are absolutely petrified with fear from AIDS to the point of, you know, starting colonies, and we've all heard it. I'm wondering, though, in expansion, if you have any plans, if the funding is included or anything of that sort, or screening in our corrections facility. Are we doing any?
No, at this time, we work very closely with the Department of Corrections to develop policies with them. Nationally, it is not recommended to screen specifically in correction facilities, although it is available if an individual were to request it. And I think that there are many serious problems that are raised about confidentiality, about risk assessment, and about the ability to intervene. Because to the degree that individuals are members of known high-risk groups, then by definition, we are trying to reach them, screen them, and counsel them. But apart from those risk groups, the fact that an individual is in a correctional facility would not place that person at risk of acquiring the infection. And so, if the high-risk groups are attacked, basically, not attacked, that's a bad word, bad choice word, but if they are screened appropriately and counseled about risk reduction behavior, that's the goal that we're trying to get.
Well, then I guess I can rephrase that. There certainly are high-risk groups incarcerated, are there not? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Are they screened?
There's no mandatory program for screening anywhere.
Is it offered?
It is available to any
individual. I mean, you go to jail, I'm sure they're in a little amount of jail or corrections, but go somewhere and take a test unless somebody's encouraged.
If they requested it, it's available through the correction medical system, and the testing would be done at our state laboratory.
Senator Joseph.
I'd like to follow those questions of the chairman. When you speak of high-risk groups, that's a euphemism for what? Homosexuals and prostitutes and Haitians, or what are you talking about?
Okay, there are the high-risk groups in whom most of the cases have occurred include the following: homosexual or bisexual males, in which 65% of all known AIDS cases have occurred, intravenous drug users, 17%, homosexual or bisexual males who are also IV drug users, an additional 8%, individuals with hemophilia or coagulation disorders who receive special blood products, 1%, heterosexual contacts of persons who have AIDS or who are at risk for AIDS, 1%, and individuals who have received in the past transfusions with blood or blood products, another 2%. There are 6% nationally of individuals apart from those groups, but many of those individuals have not had the interviews completed or information acquired to determine their risk status.
Or could be denying characteristics of high. Is there a quantum of money, an amount of money that is needed from April 22nd to June 30? Has that been
Yes, we're looking at a price of $22,000 that would get us from April to June 30th.
And is it a certainty that you will not have federal money as of that time, or are you still applying or waiting for it? Is it a certainty that you will need $22,000?
It's a certainty we will need that, and it's a certainty that we would not get enough time to get from April to June 30th.
When you mentioned, I may have missed a link here, that you do this, you encourage the not mandatory but permissive testing of people in high-risk groups. That, with education, is how you're dealing with the problem. Once a person is advised that the test is positive, then you rely on it on that person's celibacy, I suppose, or conduct modification. Is that correct?
In general, yes.
And so if you're dealing with someone who has a positive rating who is irresponsible, nothing is gained in that situation, correct?
That's true.
Our experience to this point, though, has been that at least in our communities where we're doing the screening, we have very few, we have no one who has appeared or responded to counseling in a way that we would feel that they really are interested in putting other people in risk. We hear of some of the cases in some of our San Francisco, New York reports where they're considering this problem.
Well, as legislators, we have a privacy article in our Constitution, and I think we are a tolerant society, and we should remain so. On the other hand, we do have ordinances and statutes against prostitution, for example. Is there any place in the country, any effort to screen people who either as customers of prostitutes or as convicted prostitutes appear before the judicial
arm of the government? Anchorage and Anchorage and Fairbanks, where we have our larger STD clinics, the prostitutes are well known for our STD clinics, and they are coming in already. There certainly are some that we don't know, but most of them are well known and are participating in the screening.
Perhaps I can respond as well. All prostitutes tested to this date have been negative for HDLV3 virus infection. The testing and the confidentiality issues are extremely serious ones. So nationally, there have been many recommendations among high-risk individuals not to be tested because they're concerned that the test may be used for many other purposes, which are viewed as very threatening to those individuals.
How do those stories get out there about this kid going to school with AIDS and communities get all shook up? And how do those leak? How do those come out?
Well, you know, in small communities, if an individual is diagnosed, it may be very difficult to keep that information out of the public sector. But I'm talking at the moment just about screening results. And our program up to this time has been very successful in having the screening done and then through that screening enabling one-to-one counseling, which we believe is being very effective. The problem that people are looking at nationally is, for instance, mandatory screening might mean nobody will come and get screened at all. And, you know, that's always being weighed in various parts. I think at this point, I would say that our program is unusually successful in both screening, counseling, and maintaining a good ability and trust and protection of confidentiality with appropriate detection of individuals and their self-referral of their contacts.
I don't want to sound like the ruler of the Argentine Junta or something like that, but when you talk about confidentiality, I'm talking about a situation where a person has already been charged with criminal information for prostitution. The identity of that person is therefore disclosed, is before the court convicted. What I'm groping for here is it bothers me that that individual can go into court, come out, and kind of on a revolving door basis, and never be screened. I mean, am I correct in my concern, or are you just, is there some reason why the screening should not occur, or are you satisfied that most of those folks do want screening and get screened?
I would say that female prostitutes are not known high-risk groups, that the ones that were screened in Alaska, as well as those nationally, have been negative, that the test, again, is an antibody screen, and it's not a 100% perfect test, and that's why the counseling is so important, because an individual found to have a positive result can have a very personal and decimating experience. And to find out later that the test is false, and it's very interesting that in New York, where a child was diagnosed as having a positive test and the parents wanted the child to go to school, and it ended up in a big furor about the community not wanting the child in school, et cetera, ultimately proved that that was a false positive test.
But what about persons who are convicted of crimes who are known heroin users?
Well,
do we screen those, or is it only an optional thing for them?
Again, that's an optional thing, but so far in Alaska, all IV drug users that have been screened have been negative. The IV drug use high-risk category is a difficult one because almost 90% of all of those people have been from New York City in a special drug community cadre. And so it is a risk factor, and it's an additional concern because of the blood-to-blood parenteral opportunities for the viral spread. But again, the virus is clearly difficult to catch. The Centers for Disease Control is following 1,700 healthcare workers who, while taking care of patients with AIDS, had a scalpel cut or a direct needle stick. Not one of those individuals up to this time has developed a positive test indicative that the virus set up an infection in their body.
Well, is the 2 to 7 year period an incubation period for the positiveness of the test or symptomatic criteria for this constellation of illnesses?
Good question. The incubation period is from the time the virus enters the body to the clinical manifestations occur. The antibody response would be expected to occur in about 2 to 4 weeks after the infection with the virus.
Well, finally, John, this is one of those opportunities you have to speak directly to Alaskans and let us overhear that discussion. What would you tell someone viewing this at home tonight, in terms of what they can do for themselves to avoid this illness? What you're an educator as well as a scientist. How would you educate them using this forum?
Gee, thanks. Well, I believe that the efforts to understand and control this disease have been extraordinarily effective. It's a new virus. It's one that a great deal is known of. My biggest concern is that there is such a gap between the medical knowledge of the virus and the way it's transmitted and a public personal perception of risk. As an example, hepatitis B is well known to you members and to many people in Alaska because of the control programs here. It's believed that the AIDS virus is approximately 1,000 times less infective than hepatitis B. There is a tremendous amount of information to show that family members, school contacts, the general public are not at risk of acquiring this disease through any kind of routine activities or casual contact. And I think that's the key message. Obviously, a great deal needs to be done to learn more and to identify and to counsel in the high-risk communities. But to me, that's getting a bang for your buck. And that's the purpose of epidemiology, is to define the high-risk groups and work with those in order to direct the most beneficial control measures at the most concentrated focus where they'll pay off. And I think that's where we hope we'll be able to head next year. But we believe that it's going to take more funds in FY87 than we have now. And of course, we're concerned that up till this point, the program that has evolved has been funded solely with the federal grant monies, which now are going to end on April 22nd. So we need to short-term fix it, and then we really need to, I believe, increase both the educational material and our directed efforts. And then obviously to keep abreast, as we're constantly trying to do, of any new developments that are occurring nationally or internationally will give us additional weapons to diagnose and intervene to prevent the spread of the disease.
Doctor, I'm amazed that in in the programming that has been done nationally in trying to educate the general public, always in this time of so-called sexual freedom, there's something said about promiscuousness and self-control and these kinds of things, and you didn't mention it in what was said to be what would be your message, you know, to the general public. May I ask why?
Well,
is the information I'm getting incorrect? I know there's a lot of stuff going out.
Well, I believe that, now this is just my personal opinion, that one of the reasons that there's such a gulf between the scientific evidence and between public perception is that there, some of the individuals in high-risk groups have, by their activities, are quite different from most of the general public. We have, in many of the individuals infected, as many as 600 or 1,000 sexual contacts in a year. And this is a type of behavior that is not a normal behavior for most of the public. And it's that type of practices which have permitted this virus to set up infections. One of the theories is that it requires repeated inoculation of this virus or coexistent other infections to enable the virus to wreak its havoc on the immune system. And as more information is developed about this virus and how it does infect and cause harm to the human body, which results in the disease, we'll better be able to control it. But I think that the general public is not at great risk of this disease, and that obviously celibacy is the 100% assurance that this disease is not going to be acquired.
And low blood transfusion.
That's true. But although right now, that's something, again, in Alaska, we have not had the hysterical response of the outside that has impaired blood donation. We've been very fortunate in that. And there is no risk whatsoever of acquiring AIDS from donating blood. Prior to the onset of screening, the risk of acquiring AIDS from receiving a blood donation was about 1 in 1 million units of blood administered. And that risk has gone down many fold since all blood is screened now.